Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court decided today that a man convicted of the murder of a Boston police officer is entitled to a new trial. Sean Ellis was found guilty of the 1993 shooting death of Boston Police Detective John Mulligan. But today, the SJC affirmed a lower court ruling that corrupt officers had an undue influence in the original investigation. So joining us now with more is Nancy Gertner. She's WBUR's legal analyst and a retired federal judge. Judge Gertner, it's great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Okay, so first of all, tell us a little bit about your reaction to the SJC's affirmation of the lower court's ruling regarding Sean Ellis.
Well, I mean, I think it was, candidly, it was the right decision. But what they were saying is that information critical to the case had not been turned over to the trial lawyers. So it was not just a question of the officers being corrupt. It was that there was evidence that the officers were complicit with the victim, and that therefore they wanted to have a quick investigation that would not disclose their relationships with the victim, and therefore they tainted the investigation of the case. And information about the relationship with the victim had not been turned over during the trial. And in addition, evidence of other people who had threatened the Boston officer victim had not been turned over at trial. That's a real serious integrity problem that undermines the basis of the trial, which is why they reversed the conviction.
Mm. Well, Mulligan had been shot five times in the face when he was murdered. And again, this was 1993. I mean, how is it that as two courts have now found that so much evidence was withheld from the defense, I mean, how is it that was even discovered over time?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It was discovered because Ellis's lawyer was relentless. It really is helpful to step back and say that's not the way the system's supposed to work. People are supposed to turn over exculpatory evidence. Police have access to the crime scene that defense lawyers don't. And so they have an obligation as an officer of the court to turn over evidence. You bear in mind, Ellis was tried three times. He was finally convicted the third time. The case went up on an appeal, first motion for new trial, because there was evidence of corruption in the police that had not been turned over. The court said that wasn't sufficient. This was now evidence of corruption between the officers investigating and the victim. How does it happen? It happens that there are people who are not fulfilling their constitutional obligations. And that's really, and there's an Ellis story here about a wrongful conviction. There's a story about police and prosecutors. And I have to admit there's a little bit of story about the courts that didn't look closely enough at this until now, somewhat 20 years later.
Well, so tell us more about that, because, I mean, Ellis was convicted in 1995, if I have my dates right. And so it's been 21 years.
Right.
I mean, is this case telling us about sort of a deeper problem with the court system in Massachusetts?
I don't know about the court system in general in Massachusetts, but certainly problems with courts. In other words, one of the things that we've seen in ordinary exonerations, let's say DNA exonerations, is you roll back the tape and you see that there was evidence not turned over, that there was, there was a bad eyewitness identification. And this kind of situation, which is exculpatory evidence that was not produced, is one of the reasons why we've seen false convictions.
And just to be clear, prosecuting attorneys have an obligation to turn over
right.
this evidence.
Think of it this way. If something happens in someone's home, the police have complete access to the crime scene as a matter of policy and statute. And that means that we trust them to turn over exculpatory evidence, to turn over all the information. And when they don't, the integrity of the system is undermined. The defense lawyer can't do his or her job. And the system really falters. So I think that this is a story about whatever happens to Sean Ellis. This was a new trial, so he has to be tried again. It seems to me we have to step back and ask the question you just asked. How does it happen that the police did this without accountability, that prosecutors didn't turn this over without accountability, and what is it about the review that enabled this to happen year after year?
Are there measures in place that may prevent such a thing from happening in the future? I mean, I guess I don't know. And I'm wondering if something like this could happen in 1995, where prosecutors are not turning over exculpatory evidence, that there's, you know, there's concerns about the ways the investigating officers have conducted themselves. Is there any way for someone undergoing a current trial to say with confidence there are stop gaps so that such thing does not happen?
You know, we have, it's a constitutional obligation. This is not just an ordinary obligation. To turn over exculpatory evidence is a constitutional obligation. So one way of, quote, punishing those who don't follow this constitutional obligation is to reverse a conviction. That's obviously not adequate. And it's not adequate because not every lawyer is like Rosemary Scapiccio in this case, who just would not give
up. Alice's lawyer.
Right. Yeah. This is Alice's lawyer. So there have been, arguably, this is a disciplinary violation. If a prosecutor was responsible, the police should have internal mechanisms to discipline people. If you simply rely on the reversal of convictions to enforce this right, that's not enough.
Huh.
That's not enough.
So that brings me to the question of the ruling today from the SJC is such that Sean Ellis should be granted a new trial.
Right. This would be his fourth trial.
Do you think the government will try him again?
It's hard to say. It's hard to say. Typically, when someone has done 22 years in prison, the government might say it's not worth it to go through this again for whatever additional time in his life there is. I might add, by the way, there was a co-defendant in this case whose conviction was also overturned because of a bad testimony about fingerprints. So he wound up pleading guilty to manslaughter. The theory that the SJC dealt with is the theory that Ellis was either not involved at all, or at best he was involved as after the fact, not as a shooter, which would not qualify him for a murder conviction. So I don't know. One hopes, candidly, that you would look at this and say, there's been enough punishment in this case. Why go through this again for the remaining time of his life? That doesn't make a sense.
Well, Nancy Gertner is WBUR's legal analyst. She's also a retired Massachusetts federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This Sunday marks the 15th anniversary of the attacks of September 11th, 2001. Nearly 3,000 people died that day, and over 200 of them had ties to Massachusetts. This week, we've been visiting some of the places that were important to the people who died on 9/11. Our final audio postcard is from Crocker Park in Marblehead, where the former wife of Fred Rimley remembers her husband. Fred was a passenger on United Flight 175.
My name is Kim Trudell, and I was married to Fred Rimley. On the evening of September 10th, my husband and I shared a nice romantic dinner together. He was traveling the following day, which is quite unusual. He seldom traveled for work, and I often traveled for work. So the fact that he was traveling gave us cause for a little bit of a celebration. So we had a nice candlelit dinner together and then went for a walk through town. We found ourselves here at Crocker Park. It's a rocky bluff, and it looks out over Marblehead Harbor, which is filled with about 1,500 boats. And you can nearly walk from boat to boat to boat. They're so close together. And there are lots of rock outcroppings here at the park with benches. And he and I came to sit on top of one of the rocks. It was a very quiet night. At that point, it was dark and just very still here at the park. We talked a little bit about where we were at in our lives. I was considering a career change, so I was walking through my thought process and just in general kind of appreciating his presence in my life and the guidance that he gives me. And at one point, I turned to him and I said, you know, I don't know what I would do without you in my life. Quick as a whip, he turned to me and he said, well, I would imagine that you would go on. That's what I would do.
The sound of Crocker Park in Marblehead with Kim Trudell. Her husband, Fred Rimley, was a passenger on United Flight 175 when it was crashed by hijackers into the second tower of the World Trade Center on September 11th, 2001. We first aired this audio postcard, produced by WBUR's Dan Mozzie, in 2011. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.